Okay, this is lecture number three. We have left our concentration on coherent states, and we're going to focus now for the next two lectures on path integrals, although you will, of course, see coherent states appear later in this lecture or certainly in the next lecture. Path integrals are a wonderful way to look at quantum mechanics. Actually, they are applied in many fields. Wherever there's a wave equation, there's always a path integral waiting to be used. And they are a fine way to look at problems. I'm a great believer in creating as many ways to look at a problem. My hands can give you different ways to look at a problem. And you get further insight by these different ways. So we have Schrodinger's equation for quantum mechanics here, given for the simple problem of a Hamiltonian, which is p squared over 2m and plus a potential. That's a very uniform way of treating the momentum, p squared over 2m. What's new every time is a different potential, perhaps. But, of course, that covers a great many problems of interest and was the first set of Hamiltonians to be worked on. We'll generalize that shortly. As a first-order differential equation in time, it's clear that the future of the solution is determined by the present or some initial value of the solution, psi of x at time 0. And a way to formalize that is by means of this integral equation that the solution in the future at time t is given by the distribution of the solution at an earlier time, say time 0. You integrate over the position x prime, and there's an integral kernel here, which is called the propagator, which takes you from the information at initial time to the information at a final time. This equation holds for all t. If I take the limit as t goes back towards 0 on the left-hand side, I'm reconstructing the solution at time 0, so I have psi of double x at time 0. Here is psi of x prime at time 0. X double prime is what I meant. So since this has to hold for all possible solutions, all possible initial equations, the only thing this propagator can reduced to at time at the initial condition is the time a delta function. So that's its boundary condition, if you will. It's a solution to the Schrodinger equation itself with this particular boundary condition, and that gives you the propagator itself. Of course, you could also compose propagators. You can propagate from time t prime up to t, and then some intermediate time t, and then go on to some later time t double prime. Two compositions of the propagator give you a third propagator. Of course, that's just a consequence of this integral equation. Substitute this equation back in for itself and you find this composition rule. In 1948, Feynman put forward his first proposal as to how to define the propagator by means of a path integral. It's a integral over all paths here in the picture on the left. I've symbolized that. We start at some initial point x prime at time t prime. We end at some initial final point x double prime at a later time t double prime. And we, in principle, are to sum over all paths in between. Not the classical paths, but all paths. And here is the function we're supposed to be taking that superposition over. Here is the idea to integrate over all paths. This is the weight for the paths involved. It's a phase factor. The interference of all these phase factors is supposed to give you this propagator. And one nice feature about this expression is that the classical action appears here. So this is, for the problem, the kind of Hamiltonian we're describing at the top of the board, but this is on your sheet. Top of your sheet is given here in the classical form, m over 2 x dot squared minus the potential. So that involves the Lagrangian form of the classical action. So I give that a smiling face because that's something we're familiar with. But the whole summation that we're supposed to do, the integration over all the paths, is a truly transcendental concept. And I give that a frown because that's so difficult to make precise and has attracted the attention of both mathematicians and physicists ever since 1948. I hope by the end of this two-lecture series to give you an improved appreciation for what that integral, those kind of integrals should be like. Okay, so Feynman gave us his original prescription for giving this a meaning, what was this called, a lattice regularization. We're going to take this time integral in the exponent and replace it by a Riemann sum approximation. That's at the top of slide 2-2. So we have replaced our continuous time axis by discrete steps, like I'm breakfasting here on the wall. Time step epsilon is finite, and n plus one of them is going to combine together to give us the total step. And we replace that integral in the exponent by its Riemann approximation. Here it is. This is the derivative squared. So there would be an epsilon squared in the denominator for the time difference, but we multiply by one of those because that's the delta, that's the dt in the integration. Here is, in fact, the dt multiplying the potential evaluated at the lattice point x sub L. And we sum over those lattice points from here, L equals 0 up to capital N, and do an integration over the individual points along the way. So if I could use my hand here and my fingers, time is running this way. I've broken that time into lattice levels of time here. And so we pretend that the path of the particle is a straight line in between each of these positions along the way. It's a great idea. It's a plausible place to start. But you have to prove that the limit exists and that the limit is a solution to Schrödinger's equation. This seems evident, but it has to be shown. And the illustration here of when it works and when it doesn't work is given by a bit of a technical language, but I'll explain what it means. When my quantum Hamiltonian, which is p squared over 2m plus v of q, that's my quantum Hamiltonian, if that is what's called essentially self-adjoint on a selection of vectors, I'll tell you what the vectors are, the intersection of the domain on which p squared can act and the domain on which V can act. Okay, so what does that really mean? It says that if I take the Hamiltonian for the problem and I restrict the vectors on which it can act to those for which P squared is allowed, well, what do I mean by allowed? P squared acts on a vector. It still has to be a vector in the Hilbert space. I have to integrate that when it acts on the, well, let's put one equation off transparency. This is now a, and in fact written as how that acts on that vector. I want to know that this is square integrable as well. We already know that the vector function psi of x squared dx is finite. That's what it means to be in Hilbert space. I now ask that this is also in Hilbert space. Forget the x squared, I mean the h bar squared. This has also got to be true. And second, and finally, the v of x acting on psi of x squared dx, that has got to be finite as well. So this is the condition that the vector psi is in the domain of v. This is the condition that the vector psi is in the domain of p squared as a subset of all possible vectors. And the question is, does that uniquely, that information uniquely define a self-adjoint operator? Let me give you an example for which it works and an example for which it fails.
if I choose V equal to Q to the fourth power here, a positive term here, then these conditions are fulfilled, and this prescription generates the correct quantum propagator. However, if V is minus Q to the fourth, so this is P squared over 2M minus Q to the fourth is the problem, then the conditions are not fulfilled. And this formula does not converge to the quantum mechanical solution to the problem. In point of fact, in my judgment, there is absolutely no good description of this Feynman story for V equals minus Q to the fourth in the literature today, more than 50 years later. And I would suggest in the mathematical physics world, if that was of interest to anybody, that's a topic worthy of a thesis.
What about Q squared?
Q squared plus or minus Q squared, they work. Now that you bring me to this, there is some interest in what we're talking about in the classical domain. Let's take classical Hamiltonians, which are of the kind we're talking about. P squared minus Q squared was the proposal from the audience. P squared minus Q to the fourth. I invite you to look at these because these are very educational situations. I'm going to draw the solution qualitatively for each of these as a function of time. So here is Q as time proceeds forward in the future. Of course, if this was P plus Q squared, that would be the harmonic oscillator. And that would just oscillate back and forth. But this one, on the other hand, has exponentially growing solutions, either the plus or minus T, something like that. This one, on the other hand, has the feature that it will reach infinity at a finite time. Here's my initial conditions, and that will determine when it gets there, but you can easily show that it will reach infinity at a finite time. There is a disease in the classical characterization of this problem which carries over into the quantum theory. And this is the quantum theory, a question also about how it should be defined. On the other hand, the proposal from the audience, minus Q squared, is perfectly acceptable as a solution for all time because that's the illustration of it. That has no problem quantum mechanically. Okay. Right. Now in 1950, Mark Kotz, a probabilist, was listening to a Feynman lecture, and he said, much of what Feynman is talking about for quantum mechanics has an analog in probability theory. And so, he took Schrödinger's equation, so back to 2.1 for a moment, and he's going to replace the time in here by minus I times t. He's going to rotate it in the complex plane by 90 degrees, minus it. So the I will cancel that, and the minus will come upside, so I have minus here, minus here. Let's change the sign of everything, so we'll make that a plus, and that a minus. And so he came up with the following equation from probability theory, which is here, d by dt rho equals, I'm going to set h bar equal to 1 since we're not talking about quantum mechanics, 1 over 2m, second derivative, minus v of x, acting on rho. I've also changed the name of the wave function psi into rho, because rho here has a different physics. It's clearly going to be real all the time, and moreover, it should be non-negative all the time. Nevertheless, it's still a first-order-in-time differential equation, so if I give you the solution at time 0, that's enough information to predict the solution at a future time, and there is an integral kernel which connects the two, called L here. Next letter after K, that's the only reason for that choice. It depends on the initial point here and the final point. Again, it has the feature that as t went to 0, this would collapse to a Dirac delta function. That's the initial data of that. And here is the solution to this, according to the way Feynman would think about it. When you make the changes, t goes to minus it. So there's no longer any phase factor in here. There's no more I. That's dropped out. And the expressions have become m over 2 times x dot quantity squared plus v of x dt. Again, a transcendental concept. You have to give some meaning to this. And the first natural meaning is to take the lattice formulation. So we put the integral in the exponent onto a discrete lattice following a Riemann sum approximation. The formulas, the factors that enter in are exactly analogous to those before. Here's the second derivative times the dt, and here's the dt times that. We're supposed to take the limit outside the integral as our final expression. But here comes the miracle. This is the miracle that happens in the probabilistic world, which does not happen in the quantum theoretical world. I have two operations here. I have an integration and a limit. Physicists cannot resist the temptation to interchange the two. In the quantum mechanical case, that is absolutely illegal. This does not make good mathematical sense. But in the probabilistic case, it does make good sense. And that was pointed out by Wiener himself in the late 1920s. So we can take this limit inside. This will become then a restoration of our original integral here. So here is our integral acting on the v of the x of t, just like we had before. And this combination here, along with this and this formal constant in front, becomes the Wiener measure. I'm choosing the so-called pinned Wiener measure. I want the pads all to start at x prime and end at x double prime, kind of the same picture we had on the previous transparency. But here is a genuine, oh, here it is right here, a genuine measure on pads, two pads. What is the nature of the pads? You can investigate that, and you find all of the pads are continuous pads, but they are nowhere differentiable. Such paths were actually suggested in the middle of the of an earlier century, I would say maybe 1800, 1900, I can't remember which century. But they were an absolute revelation to mathematicians. Who can think of a path which is continuous but has nowhere, has a derivative anywhere? Anyway, those are the kind of paths that feature in the Feynman-Katz formula. Okay, that's the connection of those two. Now comes Feynman's second proposal in 1950, also, same year. And he says, well, we don't need to restrict ourselves to Hamiltonians of the form p squared plus v of q. Let's make more general Hamiltonians. So here is the position for the momentum part, the minus I h bar d by dx is being replaced by. And x for the position itself is standard. Again, first order in time. So we take our initial data to give us our final solution. Again, a propagator here. Now I've changed the notation from x into q. And that's a deliberate on my part, because if I keep the x around when we're dealing with the Lagrangian story, and I use the q to remind us, as we will now see, that we're entering a phase space description of things. So P and Q are nice two neighbors in the alphabet that like to stay together. So our propagator in this particular case is given by a similar integral as before, path integral, similar transcendental idea. We have the classical Lagrangian for the theory here written in Hamiltonian or phase space form, PQ dot minus Hamiltonian. And we're instructed to integrate over not only the coordinates q, but the momenta p. In what way are we supposed to do it? As if there were two separate paths altogether, unconnected altogether. We integrate over the q path, fixed at the initial time, q point, q prime, And at the final time, I cube double prime and reintegrate over all p pairs.
That's the prescription that Feynman gives us. Again, attractive with the Lagrangian up there, transcendental, and we have to work hard. So, let's give ourselves a lattice formulation. Here is one example. There are many examples that you can write down. But here is a workable example for a lattice formulation of this. Again, what do? I take a Riemann sum approximation to the integral involved here. Here is dt times the Hamiltonian term. Here is the pq dot. There's a dt in the denominator here, which cancels that t, so there's no epsilon at all. Here's the p and the difference of the q's, which appears here. I integrate over the p's, and I integrate over the q's. When you first look at this expression, you are truly mesmerized. You should be mesmerized by the fact that this is the genuine classical action, and dp dq is the Liouville measure. So this equation looks, has the appearance of, covariance under canonical transformations. When you investigate a little bit closer down here and put it on a lattice to give it at least some semblance of a definition, you find that there is one more p integration needed than q integration. Observe, the q integration runs, they're numbering from 1 to n, the p integration is from 0 to n. So there's one more p integration. You say, oh, that doesn't look right. I'd like to have the Liouville theorem preserved. Well, there has to be, it's required by the following fact, by the composition law. I want to take a q integral over an intermediate time, t, and fold and will one k and another k to give a third k. So suppose, for example, they each had the same number of p and q integrations. Same number of p and q integrations here. Same number of p and q integrations here. But I'm adding one more q to this side. The only way I can balance the number of p and q integrations is to have one more p here in this k, one more p in this one. That's two more on this side. But I now take one of those away with a q, so I have a net of one p, which is exactly what's over here. It's not a fundamental problem, but at least it's a surprise the first time you hear about it. Okay, here is the definition of this quantity H in terms of the original Hamiltonian for the problem. It's the mixed matrix element between the state PL plus a half and QL divided by the overlap of PL and QL. And if I take the Hamiltonian, which is traditional, p squared over 2m plus v of q, then the v of q term looks to the right and sees an eigenvector, so it puts in that eigenvalue here. The p squared term looks to the left, it sees an eigenvector and puts in that eigenvalue right here. I get a lot of criticism from my colleagues for my notation. My notation is that the q variables live on integer divisions here. That's the black line at the bottom. That's q sub 0, q sub 1, q sub 2, and so on. And I made the p variables live on the half step in between. So that's the little red marker here. That's where the dashed line, if you will, that's where the p 1 half, p 3 halves, etc., that's where I labeled the p integrations. There's a reason for that. One is there is one more p integration than q. So in this elementary graphical example, we have three solid lines. Those are our q integrations. And four dashed lines. Those are our p integrations. So there's the one more. Secondly, we know that the q has the physical meaning of sharp position. If I give you that q in this equation, the physics of that is this is where the particle is. That's what this is all about, Schrodinger equation. And p, on the other hand, is where the momentum is. It's the sharp momentum. And you cannot literally have sharp position and sharp momentum at the same time because that would violate the uncertainty principle. Okay.
that example of the last one, where we had the quadratic p squared, you could actually integrate out the p variable as you're supposed to, and come back to our original formulation, which was in the Lagrangian or the coordinates we had on the first transparency. I want to spend a minute with a sketch of a proof of this formula that we have for our phase space prescription, because it will be instructive to compare this proof with the one needed for the coherent states, which will come a bit later. So here is our propagator. This is its definition in another language. It's the Q prime matrix element of the so-called evolution operator. Here I'm setting H bar equal 1 for a bit of the structure here, just to keep the notation a little simpler. Let's take this exponent and break it into n plus 1 steps of each a small times amount, a little epsilon here. So that's what this next line is. Then we put in resolutions of unity over the position in between each of these. Here's one here, etc. And order those in a temporal way, in an ordered way. So I'm integrating over the n steps I've put in between the n plus 1 of these small exponentials, dQL, and I get a multiple collection here of matrix elements with small time steps. So I have from product from 0 to capital N, and Q sub 0 is another name for Q prime, and Q sub n plus 1 is another name for Q double. Okay. So I have to find a way to estimate what this small time propagator is. And one way to do that is to put in another resolution of unity, this over the conjugate variable, the momentum here. So I'm putting in front of the exponent a resolution of unity. And as I said, there are many ways to do this. And another way to do it would be to put the resolution of momentum in the backside or average the two, things of that kind. In any case, this gives the basic idea. So I put in this resolution of unity over the momentum, the conjugate variable here. These are the integrations for those, and you can see there's always one more of those that will be needed. And then since the time step epsilon is small, I make a tiny approximation, correct to order epsilon, got an error of order epsilon squared. So a typical PQ matrix element of this term, I expand that out to first order in epsilon. I'll take the matrix elements as required, and then factor this out term in front, and then raise it up in the exponent, again making another error of order epsilon squared. So this is my, then this little calculation gives me how I'm going to replace this term. I come back to the propagator as if the Hamiltonian were 0, the matrix element as if the Hamiltonian were 0, plus this extra corrected term. Now, I now use what we know about the overlap of the Q and the P. This is just the Fourier transform situation. I get these combinations of the P's and the Q minus the Q. I pick up a square root of 2 pi h bar for each of these factors, so I get a net of 2 pi h bar. And this combination up there becomes what I call the Hamiltonian. Okay, this is the state of the art in many stories, many books. And now I'd like to make couple of comments about that. In fact, the word I would like to say is criticize, but it would be presumptuous of me to say that, so I won't say that. We've already mentioned the fact that the meaning, emphasis, meaning of the symbols P and Q is as sharp eigenvalues. If I tell you the Q, you know where the particle is. If I tell you the P value, you know where the particle's momentum is. And this construction of the situation is an alternate knowing of a Q, and then a P, and then a Q, and then a P. Here it is. I know Q at time 1, then I know P at time 3, then I know Q at times 2, and so on. I consider this to be unnatural. You don't know that. Now, on your sheet, it's in front of you. If you all look down, you'll see that the bottom word is not readable. You can't read the bottom word well. And I want you to write on the side epicycles, because that's my parallel. You don't have to write it. It's on the next page. Don't worry about it. So I say this is a true, valid mathematical formula, but it's an unnatural description. Let me give you,
remind you the story about two cycles briefly, so that you get a feel for what is natural and what is not natural.
Epicycles model planetary motion. Suppose you were an astronomer or a natural philosopher a few centuries back, and you gazed out in the heavens and you saw the vast majority of the stars moving uniformly across the sky. But a few other star-like things did crazy things. So you would measure those, and how would you measure it? You would measure the deviation of the, let's call it a planet, the deviation of the planet from the natural background. So you go to the moving frame, if you will, where you move with the natural background, and you see that the planet is moving up. So here it is. This is theta as a function of time. So here the planetary is ahead of the natural background stars. And then as time proceeds, it lags behind, catches up and goes a little ahead, etc., etc. And then after a long period of time, perhaps several years, you would be clever enough to notice it's periodic. It repeats itself. So capital T is a period for a particular planet, and this pattern will then repeat itself. You want to present this data in a mathematical way. I don't exactly know what they did do. But if you are modern and look at this kind of periodic data, you would use a Fourier series. So let's introduce a Fourier series representation of this sine of some initial phase angle, and then the various frequencies, integer multiples of frequencies, consistent with this periodic motion, with certain amplitudes. Well, I expand this out until the amplitudes get small, and then I don't bother, and I'm in the noise, so to speak. And I have a representation with three or four terms, and it works perfectly well. I can use it to predict the future. And I do well. For what? 1,000 years for this system. Of course, they went further, and they built a model. How does this situation come about? And they were in a world where circles were the only figures they were allowed to talk about because they were perfect things. And they had circles moving on circles, and that's what we today know as epicycles. But you know very well that a projection of a circle, of a moving line around a circle, is in fact a sine curve. So that's what this is. You can't argue with their data. The data is phenomenal. How they did it, I have no conception. But they made a model, and we tend to laugh or put down their model today, but for what they had and their constraints, I would say they did remarkably well. Okay, now, forgive me, dear colleagues, but that is the kind of analogy I want to make with this formula for the path integral down here. It's a mathematical formula. It's a model of how this propagator is constructed, but it has the feature that you know Q, you know P, you know Q, you know P alternately. And in the limit, as n goes to infinity and epsilon goes to zero, this is infinitesimally close. Well, you know very well that has some difficulty with it. Okay. So, we're going to turn to another form of path integral, which is called coherence-safe path integral, introduced in 1960. And I will illustrate how that works. So here is our wave function solution to Schrödinger's equation at time capital T. It has two labels, P and Q, because these are the labels of the basis vectors, the coherent state we talked about in our two previous lectures. Here's our original state psi, and this is the propagator, the evolution operator, which moves it forward from time zero to time capital T. I can find the integral kernel of interest to me by putting in the resolution of unit at this point. That would be this right here. So I'm integrating over P prime, Q prime, bra and ket, with appropriate measure for the problem. And that gives me the initial wave function. This is then the kernel which propagates me forward. This is the propagator in the coherent state representation. Interestingly, you can ask yourself, okay, let's look at it. Here is then the propagator. You can ask yourself, what is the limit of this quantity as t goes to zero? We've done that before now. As t goes to zero, the same function is repeated over here. And you would say, well, it has to be the delta function. But the answer is no, because that is what, as t goes to zero, that is the coherent state overlap function, a smooth function. You say, how can that be? How can this reproduce everything that's possible here over here? It doesn't have to, because the coherent state functions are not every square integral function. They're a limited subclass. And this kernel, which is this person right here, does indeed reproduce those. Okay, so much for that little remark. Let's go back to our formula. Here is our expression for the propagator function. We again break the time into n plus 1 steps of infinitesimal small size epsilon, and therefore break our exponent into many. But this time we put in a single kind of resolution of unity after each time. That is the resolution of unity over the coherent state. So when we do that, we're going to have a collection of coherent state matrix elements of small time propagators. There will be a product of those from 0 to capital N, an integration from 1 to capital N, same old story. Of course, over here, these are our integrations, and they come with a dp and a dq. Every one of those integrations come with a dp and a dq. So we do fulfill the Liouville criterion. Okay, our next step is to approximate the small time quantity, and we do that in a manner somewhat similar to what we did before. We expand in a small constant of epsilon. We take the matrix elements as indicated. We again approximate those by putting them upstairs, factoring out this factor. So this quantity upstairs is then the ratio of the off-diagonal matrix element of the Hamiltonian divided by the coherent state overlap itself. So that's a formula for the lattice prescription, which would give us that quantity. Okay, so there is our final expression here. If you wanted to put it on a computer, this is what you would try to calculate. You would have these overlap functions. You would have this exponential term here. You would integrate over those and try to take a large limit. Of course, we can proceed differently analytically. We can pretend that it's legitimate. Of course, it is, strictly speaking, not. Or we can interchange the limit with the integrations and write for the integrand the form it has for continuous and differentiable paths. And our trick for doing that is going to use the fact that for continuous paths, that this vector is going to be very close to these. You remember, the coherent state had the feature of continuity in the label. Here is Y. Here is where it's becoming useful. So this vector is very close to that vector. That means I can write it in a slightly different form, 1 minus this unit vector here, and then the correction factor, which brings it to that. But now this vector being close to that, this is a small quantity, I can approximate it upstairs and replace the minus sign by 2i's. So with that little trick, the formula for continuous and differentiable paths for this propagator is given here. In the I by h bar, I times h bar, I've simply introduced it to 2 h bars, one upstairs, one downstairs here.
These two I's are those two I's. PQ, DPQ, minus in the limit, as these don't become the same, then the denominator is unity, and this becomes the diagonal matrix element of Hamilton. I asked you to think back over the last two lectures and remember this kind of ingredient. This was our symplectic potential for the coherent states. This was one of our symbols. We call it the H-bar augmented classical Hamiltonian. Indeed, we had an expression exactly of this form, which I tried to promote to you as the classical action coming from the quantum action by restricting the range of motion of the abstract vector psi down to those only allowed by the coherent state. So once again, here is the classical action, if you will, appearing in our pandinical construction, but here it is totally described in quantum language. Nevertheless, when we put in what the coherent states are for this, this comes out to be PQ dot minus our definition of this quantity, which was HPQ. So again, we have come back to our familiar-looking formal pad integral. This is the very expression that Feynman himself wrote down in 1950. He gave one prescription to it. The coherent states give us another prescription. And let's see if my epicycle analogy can be improved. What is the meaning of P and Q in this language? It is not that of sharp eigenvalues. It means mean values. I remind you of one formula we had on a previous gathering in this room. For example, we had that expectation value of capital P in the coherent state was little p. It was a mean value. Same thing for capital Q. And it is no violation of any uncertainty situation to specify both of these things simultaneously. They're two properties of the mean value and do not violate uncertainty situations at all. So it is possible to simultaneously know these p and q because they are mean values. I consider this to be a much more natural formulation of the problem than the previous one. Okay. So,
Jonah,
yes, question.
Maybe I missed it in the previous lecture, but why say this get 2 minus 1 small? Why can't you do this trick?
So the question is, why is 2 minus 1 small? I'm interchanging these.
Or if you want the, not 2 minus 1, but when you do this, the product. So why is the projection of 2 minus 1 over 2 small?
I am taking this limit inside. I am therefore trying to go from the discrete lattice picture to a continuous picture. But for the integrand, I would like to write down what it is for continuous and differentiable pairs. Now, from a measure point of view, there is no true measure here, but if there was a measure, there is no, the set of differentiable and continuous pairs has measure zero, but that doesn't matter. Let's pretend we can do that. So if this is going to be a continuous pair, that means PL, QL has got to be close to the point PL plus 1, QL plus 1. So this unit vector is very close to that unit vector, hence the difference in length of those two vectors is extremely small. So the overlap with that length is a very small quantity. And I can raise that up to the exponent.
That's the explanation of that.
Okay. So
we've come out of time, and I would like to pause at this point because we just this opens up another whole chapter. And we'll meet you on September 28th at 2:15. 14:15. I made a mistake last time. I told all of us to meet at 2:15. And of course, when I arrived this morning, nobody was here. And then I finally understood. I was